And welcome to the third episode of Discourse, the RSP's news and current affairs show. I guess that sounds a little bit kind of CNN, but that's kind of what we're doing. We're trying to take a critical look at religion in the media, and that's religion with quote marks around it. How does the word operate in the public sphere? How is discourse on religion operating? I'm joined today by Benjamin Marcus and Essie McKella. I'm going to pass over to introduce yourself. Let's hear from you first, Essie.
Okay, hello. So I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Helsinki, and I'm working on the registration of new and pagan communities, religious communities in Finland. And yeah, my study is basically rhetorical and discourse analysis, critical discourse analysis point of view. So I guess this is a very suitable show for me to be.
Yes, very much so. And Ben, introduce yourself.
Great. Hi, everyone. My name is Ben Marcus. I am the religious literacy specialist at the Religious Freedom Center of the Freedom Forum Institute in Washington, D.C. We're a nonpartisan, nonsectarian organization that seeks to educate the public about the religious liberty principles of the First Amendment. And my particular role is that I lead our education team and design training and curricular resources for educators who want to teach about religion in academically rigorous and constitutionally appropriate ways in the United States.
And constitutionally appropriate is a good link into our first story. Ben, do you want to tell us what that is?
Yeah, so earlier this month in the United States, we had the midterm elections, and it was quite historic in a number of ways, including that for the first time, Americans elected two Muslim women to the U.S. Congress, one of whom is Ilhan Omar, who's an elected official from Minnesota's 5th District. She's a Somali-American woman. She's the first Minnesotan of color to be elected to Congress and the first refugee elected to Congress. She also, interestingly, wears a hijab, and there is an old rule in the House chamber that goes back to 1837 that outlawed the wearing of head coverings. Specifically, it was designed for hats, but now because it's a blanket rule, it applies to people with religious head coverings. So there's a conversation in the United States about changing the rules so that people who wear religious head coverings, including Muslims who have hijabs or Jews who wear kippahs or Sikhs who have turbans, would be allowed to address Congress with their religious garb. So I think this is a really interesting conversation about what constitutes a religious head covering, how in the United States we differentiate between religious head coverings or religious garb or religious symbols and things that are not religious. And the extent to which it's important to make those differentiations, in particular because of the First Amendment and this ethic that we have in the United States of making accommodations for sincerely held religious beliefs and actions that flow from those sincerely held religious beliefs. So I'm curious for you two, as folks who aren't based in the United States, how does this strike you from your vantage point? Does this seem like an obvious thing that we should be making these kinds of accommodations? I know in certain parts of Europe, those kinds of accommodations aren't being made. And so I'd love to hear your perspective.
Well, to me, I can think of two sort of connections, because you probably also have the Pastafarians in the US with the colander head wearing situation, sort of claiming that to be a religious headgear and then wearing that in driver's licenses. And then in Finland there has been some discussion about Sikh turbans if a bus driver is wearing his turban and can police wear a hijab and that kind of discussion. So I think it's at least the discussion is going on in multiple levels. I'm just thinking about the Pastafarians being a bit of a sort of funny side kick on the side, but discussion.
notice that the wording of it is for sincerely held religious belief. Mm. And this has come up in court cases in Britain as well. It came up in some pagan applications. This idea that there's sincere religious belief and like, but I mean, I don't know how we can legislate for sincerity. How do we quantify and define sincerity? We certainly know that there's a lot of people who regularly attend church and will show up in every single census as Christian or Jewish or whatever, who have no sort of deistic beliefs whatsoever. So I have questions about this idea of sincere belief anyway.
Yeah, and in this isn't about headgear, but in the Finnish like registration of religious communities, there has been some discussion not about sincerity, perhaps, but about being serious, like because you cannot evaluate sincerity from outside of a person's head. So it's been changed into the discussion of whether the application is serious or not. So it's like the evaluative boards sort of don't comment on the sincerity of the beliefs, but they comment on the seriousness of the application. So they sort of so they skip that part. But this is a very interesting thing, especially when the Pastafarians do claim that they do have serious and sincere beliefs in their philosophy and religion. So
well, absolutely. I mean, for the Pastafarians, a critique of the role of religion in the public sphere can be a very sincere belief, even if the flying spaghetti monster itself isn't. Yeah, Ben, do you think that this is likely to be used as a kind of as a sort of stick to beat non-Christian politicians with in the US?
I don't think so. I think we've seen politicians on both the right and the left advocate for Ilhan Omar and recognize the need for the change in the rule, in part because this argument can be used on both sides of the aisle. It's a religious freedom argument. On the left, it's seen as recognizing the increasing religious diversity in the United States and the importance of welcoming members of historically marginalized religious communities into public conversations, including into the halls of power in Congress. And on the right, I think it's a way of recognizing the persistent importance of religious freedom, and by acquiescing to the request for a change in the rule, it's a way for the right, I think, to continue to show why religion is salient in American public life and why requests for accommodation for other kinds of reasons should be honored. So, you know, thinking about the court case about Masterpiece Cake Shop, which was about a baker not wanting to bake a cake related for a same-sex wedding. You know, these continued conversations about the role of religious freedom domestically is much more fraught than it is internationally. And so when there's a point at which both Republicans and Democrats can agree on a religious freedom issue domestically, it is something that quite a number of people from across the political spectrum seize on that opportunity because it doesn't come along often.
Well, that's a fairly positive outcome of that. Actually, there has been quite a bit of rancor about these kind of issues. We had a cake shop as well, surprisingly. I don't know why cake shops have been the flashpoint for these kind of discussions. Although there are other more positive examples. Like there's now an official hijab version of the British police uniform, for instance. But let's move to Essie now with a slightly different aspect of religious freedom in the US.
Yes. So there is a TV show called Sabrina Teenage Witch, and Netflix was sued by Satanic Temple because they had used the Satanic Temple's Baphomet statue, and apparently it's been settled now, the case, so it didn't have to go all the way to the courts, but the discussion concerning whether the Satanic Temple has a right to sue Netflix because of the copyrights or because this statue was depicted in a very negative sort of connotation about Satanism, and it has been said that in some context that I've been following, and apparently even the Satanic Temple's leader have received a lot of hate mail, or that's how he calls it, about this situation. Like, do they have the right to sort of stand up for the public image of Satanism by suing a TV show for using their statue that also has a copyright kind of situation going on? So
to clarify, the court case was about a breach of copyright. Mm.
Yes.
Not about the portrayal of Satanism.
No, but they did take up the portrayal of Satanism in the sort of as to stand up for their case. Mm. So the actual legal case was about copyrights, but then they supported it by saying that this is a very negative image of Satanism you're portraying with our statue, and then you're kind of connecting it
right
to us.
Possibly the copyright image they pushed, the copyright issue, they pushed that because they were unhappy about the portrayal, but they didn't really have any legal recourse. And so they went for, Well, of course, I've not watched it myself, but I've heard a little bit about it, and I understand that the version of Satanism that's put forward in it is and sort of connects them with cannibalism and kind of it's very much the American right's imagination of Satanism rather than the presumably Levian kind of satanic church that's doing the suing.
Well, Satanic Temple has been, I think the Church of Satan that is actually founded by LaVey has sort of criticized Satanic Temple for just being humanistic and not really Satanistic. So there is this orthodoxy discussion going on. So I think that also is part of the... Because people have been very confused because of the temple, Satanic Temple's idea of Satanism. It's not like supposed to... Like, for them, it was supposed to just be a joke and to criticize the status of religion in the society. Uh-huh. And now that if you're sort of taking yourself too seriously by suing this just a funny TV show, then you're sort of becoming a religious movement yourself and not just a joke anymore. And then I think... I don't know too much about the Satanic Temple, but the discussions were revolving on the idea that do they actually have a right to stand up for Satanism because they do not actually practice real Satanism.
So there's also an internal debate within Satanism as to...
Apparently.
No, that's interesting. I didn't know that there was a sort of... That sounds like the Temple of Satan's operating very much the same way that the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster does, in that this is essentially about challenging, or at least satirizing, the way that religion functions in the public sphere, which is that's really interesting.
Yeah, and these people's reactions when they were disappointed that it's not a joke anymore, it sounded a bit like those Pastafarians in Italy who were disappointed and are we now practicing actual religious rituals, while they thought that they would just be promoting anti-religious agenda in the politics.
Yeah. I made it all up, but it came true anyway.
Yeah.
Did this register in the States at all, Ben?
It did, and what struck me about this news story was the parallels that I saw between what the church was doing and blasphemy laws. In the United States, there's a strong aversion to blasphemy laws, this idea that you can sue if you feel that your religious community is being slandered in a particular way. And I was wondering if that was really coming across there, if it struck anyone else as a version of a blasphemy law. I wasn't quite sure what the standing was besides the copyright. And even there, it seemed to me that religious symbols are not something that can particularly be copywritten. Not that I'm a copyright lawyer, but it was just a curious case to me all around, because there was this sense that religious symbols were being used in pop culture in a way that the church was uncomfortable with, but that didn't strike me as quite right. And then the underlying argument that the show was misportraying or doing a disservice to the religious community, I just didn't think that that was a really strong argument, that certainly the show might be criticized for its portrayal of the religious community, but that wasn't necessarily a good argument for coming after them legally.
No, and I think the copyright issue is basically because it's not just a random platform that Sabrina is using, because the sort of more traditional, if you can say, platform statues have breasts, and this one doesn't have breasts, so it's not as androgynous. It's actually, I haven't actually seen the picture of the statue in the TV show, but from what I heard, it's exactly the same as the temple of, or satanic temple.
Yeah, I have seen it, but it seems to me that it's the one from Eliphaz Levi ritual of
Hot Magi.
It doesn't have breasts, but it's got, I think it's got the one hand up and the one hand down. It's a very, like, I don't know that they would have a very strong copyright case on this, to be honest.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it's, these issues of copyright and things are frequently more prominent in new religions than they are in more established religions. I mean, these debates about copyright, for instance, have been going back and forth in the Crowleyan groups for years and years. And I think it's to do with how small these groups are. So the copyright over the material is often one of the few sort of claims to legitimacy that they have, but they also want to prevent further schisming. And there's also a financial incentive as well, that they don't have great sources of income, and so they need to be very kind of aggressive about what they do have. Whereas, you know, something like a Christianity has been so diverse for a long time that these challenges are much less effective. Shall we move to another story?
Sure.
I think it was my turn, wasn't it? Let's see. Oh, yeah. Okay, so staying in America for a minute then. I have been struck for a little while in the... obviously, I've done a fair bit of work in conspiracy theories, and so I follow a number of right-wing groups on Twitter and various other places. But, of course, being a religious studies academic, I also... come into a lot of left-wing groups stuff, and I've been struck by the use of the word cult in public discourse on Trump in particular, and, you know, Trump's followers are like a cult, these kind of stories we saw a few. And one came up the other day, which I wanted to bring up here, and it's a Wired article called "Online Conspiracy Groups Are a Lot Like Cults." And again, rather than... particularly rehash the debate that the term cult is, you know, it's just a term for a religion I don't like, Gordon Melton's term, and you can listen to our interview with Eileen Barker talking about cults. Rather, I want to look at the specific work that's being done by the term cult here. Why has this author decided to make the connection between conspiracy groups and cults? And I think it's got a lot to do with politics. So Wired tends to be broadly left leaning, and the other, you know, another story that they had recently was about the how conspiracy theorists took over America, and there's a lot of critique in the left of the Trump administration being based in conspiracy theories with some truth, of course. The fact is, though, that the term cult in the sort of 60s era emerges at the same time as this Cold War discourse on brainwashing. The idea was that, you know, for a lot of white Americans who were trying to understand why children who were raised as good Christians suddenly became New Agers or Buddhists or whatever, you know, whatever they dropped out into, came up with the idea of brainwashing, that certain groups, certain charismatic figures used deliberate techniques which removed the agency and moved the rationality of people. And this was a kind of explanation for why apparently irrational or alien groups and ideologies could spread. So it was very related to the sort of Cold War context, in which, you know, why would Westerners become you know, suddenly turn into communists, for instance. So essentially what I'm saying here is that the comparison between conspiracy groups and, by implication, Trump supporters being brainwashed cult members with all of the connotations of zombies, kind of a lack of individual agency, a lack of rational thought, brainwashing, and cults are supposedly able to, you know, take away your ability to think rationally. Because obviously, if you thought rationally, then you must, by implication, be left-wing and probably Christian and certainly a capitalist. So I think it's very interesting. The kind of this article is very much a part of the ongoing polarization where both sides of the debate seem to want to portray each other as being incapable of rational thought, very far from the sort of consensus politics of the 50s and 60s, I think. But it's interesting to see a term very much discredited within academic study of religion, and a term which insiders never use. Nobody describes themselves as a cult, seriously. But nonetheless, this term, you know, from 60, 70 years ago, is being mobilized here in an attempt to discredit your opposition. Yeah, has anybody got any further thoughts on that?
Okay, sorry about that. I think it's a really interesting question in particular because this is the 40th anniversary of the Jonestown Massacre in the United States, and I've seen a number of news articles about that. So my thinking is colored by some of the articles that I've read, but I wonder if the use of the word cult also is meant to evoke a certain sense of apocalypticism, not only the brainwashing, but the idea that the members of that community are engaging in rhetoric that is almost Manichaean in a way, this sense that there's a good versus evil, a battle that's taking place not only at the political level, but also at this almost cosmic level between forces of good and evil. And the use of the word maybe is meant to portray the other community as deploying this apocalyptic rhetoric and to criticize them for doing so. But at the same time, the use of the word itself is a way of setting up a binary distinction between those who are good and those who are evil, or those who are rational and those who are irrational.
It's very insightful, Ben. The article actually starts with the sentence, "In recent months there's been an increase in stories in which a follower of radical conspiracies shifts their actions from the web and into the world," and then gives examples of, you know, standoff at Hoover Dam, the comet ping pong shooting, and, you know, a bunch of different sort of people taking violent actions. So I think you're absolutely on point with that one.
I'm curious, for, again, the sort of European perspective, a lot of these cults, unfortunately, a lot of the conversation is about the United States. Are you seeing things in Europe where the conspiracy theories are creating communities of folks who are bringing their actions from the web into the world?
To some degree, it doesn't seem to have the same sort of standoffy. I think it doesn't tend to escalate into violence as easily here, just because people don't have guns. But there's certainly been a few instances. Yeah, you know, we've had the couple of things in London Bridge and so on and so forth. Yeah, I think that sort of, you know, Jonestown and Waco and various other things, it does, there's a particular version of the cult narrative that even when people use it here, evokes an American context rather than a British context. Essie, you had something to...
Yeah, I was just thinking about, I think it was Trelsch who had the theory on cults and churches.
Yes.
And his definition of cults, if I remember right, was about them not being able to sort of cope with the society or not wanting to work together with the society, like, you mm-hmm. know, going away somewhere, maybe killing themselves sort of mm-hmm. Idea. I'm just thinking whether calling someone a cult also suggests that they are not also capable of you know, cooperation. So you're kind of, you don't have to reason with them because, well, of course they are brainwashed and that kind of things, but also because they are incapable of actually working towards the good of the whole society and they want good for only themselves. So it's just kind of a separation of the big image. That's just the thought that I had.
Yeah, so not only disenfranchising them, but actually... legitimizing, like not really engaging with them, we don't even have to try and work productively with these people because they are by their nature world denying and exclusive and just want to shut themselves off. Yes. Yeah, that's a very interesting point. Essie, you had a second story for us, I believe, about Finnish context.
Yes, there has been this situation with Bishop of Oulu, whose headgear again resembled the one of the heavy metal band's ghost singers, sort of character called Papa Emeritus III. And the thing is that there is the Saint Peter's cross on the bishop's headgear, so that is the cross that is upside down, so to say, and that's also been used by heavy metal enthusiasts and Satanists, and also it's been connected to the Satanic Panic sort of discussion earlier. So this music magazine actually brought up the picture of Papa Emeritus III and then the Bishop of Oulu in his new headgear and compared them, like saying that they are like twins. And so some journalists went and asked then the designer of the hat of the bishop and some church workers at the sort of Oulu area and asked what they think about this new discussion online. And I don't know, the most interesting part to me was the discussion that the designer said that it would be, first actually it was written that she said that it would be uncivilized to say that the symbol means anything else than St. Peter's cross. But then later she corrected that and said that she meant that the discussion online is uncivilized because it is hate speech. It is it's like witch trials and online lynching. And she actually used very strong language to talk about this kind of sort of small thing that it seemed like just a funny joke, at least from maybe my perspective, but then I was thinking that she was maybe talking to some more conservative Christian people who might have some problems with the idea of attaching this kind of heavy metal, satanic, Satan worship imagery to the Bishop of Oulu and that kind of putting the whole thing down, and so the designer kind of first refused to even read some of the hate speech as she coined it, and then even the clergy at the church mentioned that they have actually some better things to do than follow this kind of social media discussion, and they did say that they didn't even think about the connection with the heavy metal or satanic cross with the Saint Peter's cross while they were planning the designs for the clothing. But later on, the clergy did say that they knew about this connection, but because the context was Christian, it wouldn't be connected to the heavy metal. So they kind of... first, they were really... sort of defensive that we didn't even discuss this and this is uncivilized to even mention anything. And then they sort of started more to teach about the symbolism of St. Peter's cross and how you're supposed to... Well, actually, the designer is the most vocal in this discussion because she said that you shouldn't give up to the metal heads, the metal guys, and you should keep fighting against their idea of stealing this kind of Christian symbolism, which is... interesting also because it's not actually in the Bible that Saint Peter has said that he wanted to be crucified upside down, but it was an apocryphic text, so that kind of brings up another level, I think, in the discussion. But there was a little storm in a glass.
Yeah, Ben, you're just back from the AAR, I believe. I want to get to this story before we... before we run out of time completely, could you tell us, there's been a change in the constitution, is that right? Or the mission statement?
That's right. It's a change in the mission statement. So my understanding is that the former mission statement of the American Academy of Religion was fostering excellence in the study of religion. And this year, just a few months ago, and at the AAR annual conference last week, they really emphasize the change in the mission statement, which is now read as to foster excellence in the academic study of religion and enhance the public understanding of religion. So there are these two new elements in the mission statement. One is clarifying it's not just excellence in the study of religion, but the academic study of religion. And then the second piece, which is that it's to enhance the public understanding of religion. So both of these are quite contested. Obviously, it brings up the question of what is the academic study of religion versus the confessional or devotional study of religion? Who gets to decide what is academic or devotional? And then also the question of the public understanding of religion. What are our goals? What do we want the public to understand? And that's very much tied with the question of academics. Do we want the public to understand what is academic versus devotional to be able to make that distinction? How do we make that distinction? What are we prioritizing? When we advocate for public scholarship, a number of the sessions at the AAR annual meeting were about public scholarship, including a pre-conference workshop that I presented at, and there was a plenary discussion on public scholarship. So it's quite interesting to see the Academy change its perspective on its role, both in the Academy and outside the Academy. And I wonder, for you all, how you perceive this change, if it seems like something that is really more superficial than not. Do you see it as coming in line with European or British models for public scholarship about religion or just the study of religion? Is this old hat or do you see a real change here?
The European context is, I mean, it's slightly different in that most of the big departments of religion in Europe were theology departments, or sometimes for centuries before they were religious studies departments. And that goes for a lot of the academic sort of the various groups, such as the BASR, the EASR, the European Association, are very strongly invested in being non-confessional, social scientific, kind of approaches. And the EASR added, a line about that they were focused on the academic study, the academic non-confessional study, and that this is not a site for confessional or theological work. I think maybe 10 years ago, and the BASR added it to their constitution 2 or 3 years ago, although that had always been assumed. Here, the situation is that we're sort of struggling to create a forum for academic non-confessional study of religion in a context in which the theological study was always the norm for a long time. Now, my understanding is that the US is slightly different in that you tend to have RS departments who are now fearing the creeping encroach of more theological confessional approaches. But I also, I think given the AAR, I know there's been a lot of discussion recently about the big tent approach of the AAR and the ongoing relationship with the SBL, I hope I've got that right, meaning that certainly for our colleagues in the NAASR, see the AAR as being increasingly co-opted by kind of confessional studies. So I personally would welcome that line. I would be quite interested to hear what you make of the second edition about the public role of the AAR, given that that's very much kind of what you do, Ben.
Yeah, well, I see it as a very welcome addition. A lot of the conversations that I've seen within the academy about religion just have not filtered out to the general public. A lot of the work that I do is on public education, working in K-12 public schools to try to teach young students about what the academic study of religion is and how it fits into a wider social studies curriculum. And it's sort of high time that the academy takes seriously its role as not only an internal conversation among academics about what religion is and how religions operate in private and public life, but also how we teach the general public to understand the role of religion in society. So I'm not 100% sure what this will look like. We obviously don't want to dilute rigorous scholarship about religion or downplay its importance, but I would certainly welcome a greater appreciation for the need to be able to translate a long book about a particular religious subject to an op-ed. I don't think that that is necessarily a weakening of the academic project. In fact, I think it's the opposite, to be able to communicate complex ideas, not only in long form, but in very short formats, would go a long way toward improving public discourse about religion.
I very much agree. The RSP was set up in a large part to try and do that, to try and, put forward complex ideas in a more accessible kind of forum. I completely agree. As long as it doesn't become, as you sort of suggested yourself there, as long as the academic rigor remains there, that doesn't have to mean that it's inaccessible, but it has to be more than simply telling people why religion's good and the difference between nice religion and nasty religion. Improving the public's literacy on religion and how these terms, these very powerful terms, are operating in the media, which we've seen many examples of here today.
Absolutely.
Maybe that's a good time to wrap up. We've hit 40 minutes already. I want to thank you both for taking part, and
thank you.
And thanks to our audience for listening.
Yeah, thank you so much.